Bush owes us an apology, MSNBC. Keith Olbermann, September 18, 2006. The President of the United States owes this country an apology. It will not be offered, of course. He does not realize its necessity. There are none around him who would tell him or could. The last of them, it appears, was the very man whose letter provoked the president into the conduct for which the apology is essential. An apology is this president's only hope of regaining the slightest measure of confidence of what has been, for nearly 2 years, a clear majority of his people. Not confidence in his policies nor in his designs, nor even in something as narrowly focused as which vision of Deutsche shall prevail, his, or that of the man who has sent him into apoplexy, Colin Powell. In a larger sense, the president needs to regain our confidence that he has some basic understanding of what this country represents, of what it must maintain, if we are to defeat not only terrorists, but if we are also to defeat what is ever more increasingly apparent as an attempt to redefine the way we live here, and what we mean when we say the word freedom. Because it is evident now that, if not its architect, this president intends to be the contractor for this narrowing of the definition of freedom. The president revealed this last Friday, as he fairly spat through his teeth, words of unrestrained fury directed at the man who was once the very symbol of his administration, who was once an ambassador from this administration to its critics, as he had once been an ambassador from the military to its critics. The former Secretary of State, Mr. Powell, had written, simply and candidly and without anger, that the world is beginning to doubt the moral basis of our fight against terrorism. This president's response included not merely what is apparently the presidential equivalent of threatening to hold one's breath, but within it contained one particularly chilling phrase. Mr. President, former Secretary of State Colin Powell, says the world is beginning to doubt the moral basis of our fight against terrorism, he was asked by a reporter. If a former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and former Secretary of State feels this way, don't you think that Americans and the rest of the world are beginning to wonder whether you're following a flawed strategy? If there's any comparison between the compassion and decency of the American people and the terrorist acts of extremists, it's flawed logic, Bush said. It's just, simply can't accept that. It's unacceptable to think that there's any kind of comparison between the behavior of the United States of America and the action of Islamic extremists who kill innocent women and children to achieve an objective. Of course, it's acceptable to think that there's any kind of comparison. And in this particular debate, it is not only acceptable, it is obviously necessary, even if Mr. Powell never made the comparison in his letter. Some will think that our actions at Abu Ghraib, or in Guantanamo, or in secret prisons in Eastern Europe, are all too comparable to the actions of the extremists. Some will think that there is no similarity, or, if there is one, it is to the slightest and most unavoidable of degrees. What all of us will agree on is that we have the right, we have the duty, to think about the comparison. And, most importantly, that the other guy, whose opinion about this we cannot fathom, has exactly the same right as we do to think and say what his mind and his heart and his conscience tell him is right. All of us agree about that. Except, it seems, this president. With increasing rage, he and his administration have begun to tell us we are not permitted to disagree with them, that we cannot be right, that Colin Powell cannot be right. And then there was that one, most awful phrase. In four simple words last Friday, the president brought into sharp focus what has been only vaguely clear these past 5.5 years, the way that terrain at night is perceptible only during an angry flash of lightning, and then, a second later, all again is dark. It's unacceptable to think, he said. It is never unacceptable to think. And when a president says thinking is unacceptable, even on one topic, even in the heat of the moment, even in the turning of a phrase extracted from its context, he takes us toward a new and fearful path, one heretofore the realm of science fiction authors and apocalyptic visionaries. That flash of lightning freezes at the distant horizon, and we can just make out a world in which authority can actually suggest it has become unacceptable to think. Thus the lightning flash reveals not merely a president we have already seen, the one who believes he has a monopoly on current truth. It now shows us a president who has decided that of all our commanders-in-chief, ever, he alone has had the knowledge necessary to alter and reshape our inalienable rights. This is a frightening and a dangerous delusion, Mr. President. If Mr. Powell's letter, cautionary, concerned, predominantly supportive, can induce from you such wrath and such intolerance, what would you say, were the statement to be shouted to you by reporter, or written to you by colleague? Governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. That whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter, or to abolish it, and to institute new government. Those incendiary thoughts came, of course, from a prior holder of your job, Mr. Bush. They were the words of Thomas Jefferson. He put them in the Declaration of Independence. Mr. Bush, what would you say to something that antithetical to the status quo just now? Would you call it unacceptable for Jefferson to think such things, or to write them? Between your confidence in your infallibility, sir, and your demonizing of dissent, and now these rages better suited to a thwarted three-year-old, you have left the unnerving sense of a White House coming unglued, a chilling suspicion that perhaps we have not seen the peak of the anger, that we can no longer forecast what next will be said to, or about, anyone who disagrees, or what will next be done to them. On this newscast last Friday night, constitutional law professor Jonathan Turley of George Washington University suggested that at some point in the near future some of the detainees transferred from secret CIA cells to Guantanamo will finally get to tell the Red Cross that they have indeed been tortured. Thus the debate over the Geneva Conventions might not be about further interrogations of detainees, but about those already conducted, and the possible liability of the administration for them. That, certainly, could explain Mr. Bush's fury. That, at this point, is speculative. But at least it provides an alternative possibility as to why the president's words were at such variance from the entire history of this country. 4. There needs to be some other explanation, Mr. Bush, than that you truly believe we should live in a United States of America in which a thought is unacceptable. There needs to be a delegation of responsible leaders, Republicans or otherwise, who can sit you down as Barry Goldwater and Hugh Scott once sat Rick Hard Nixon down, and explain the reality of the situation you have created. There needs to be an apology from the President of the United States, and more than one. But, Mr. Bush, the others, for warnings unheeded 5 years ago, for war unjustified 4 years ago, for battle unprepared 3 years ago, they are not weighted with the urgency and necessity of this one. We must know that, to you, thought with which you disagree, and even voice with which you disagree, and even action with which you disagree, are still sacrosanct to you. The philosopher Voltaire once insisted to another author, "I detest what you write, but I would give my life to make it possible for you to continue to write." Since the nation's birth, Mr. Bush, we have misquoted and even embellished that statement, but we have served ourselves well by subscribing to its essence. Oddly, there are other words of Voltaire's that are more pertinent still, just now. "Think for yourselves," he wrote, "and let others enjoy the privilege to do so too. Apologize, sir, for even hinting at an America, where if you have that privilege to think, and the rest of us get yelled at by the president. Anything else, Mr. Bush, is truly unacceptable." September 18, 2006, 5:08 p.m. at tonight's special comment. Tune in to Countdown at 8 p.m. at for another special comment from Keith Olbermann. Here's a preview. The President of the United States owes this country an apology. It will not be offered, of course. he does not realize its necessity. There are now none around him who would tell him, or could. The last of them, it appears, was the very man whose letter provoked the president into the conduct for which the apology is essential. An apology is this president's only hope of regaining the slightest measure of confidence of what has been, for nearly 2 years, a clear majority of his people. September 11, 2006, 8:32 p.m. At this hole in the ground half a lifetime ago, I worked in this now empty space. And for 40 days after the attacks, I worked here again, trying to make sense of what happened, and was yet to happen, as a reporter. All the time, I knew that the very air I breathed contained the remains of thousands of people, including 4 of my friends, 2 in the planes and, as I'd discovered from those missing posters seared still into my soul, 2 more in the towers. And I knew, too, that this was the pyre for hundreds of New York policemen and firemen, of whom my family can claim half a dozen or more, as our ancestors. I belabor this to emphasize that, for me this was, and is, and always shall be, personal. And anyone who claims that I and others like me are soft comic quote or have forgotten the lessons of what happened here is at best a grasping, opportunistic, dilettante and at worst, an idiot whether he is a commentator, or a vice president, or a president. However, of all the things those of us who were here 5 years ago could have forecast, of all the nightmares that unfolded before our eyes, and the others that unfolded only in our minds, none of us could have predicted this. 5 years later, this space is still empty. 5 years later, there is no memorial to the dead. 5 years later, there is no building rising to show with proud defiance that we would not have our America wrung from us by cowards and criminals. 5 years later, this country's wound is still open. 5 years later, this country's mass grave is still unmarked. 5 years later, this is still just a background for a photo op. It is beyond shameful. At the dedication of the Gettysburg Memorial, barely 4 months after the last soldier staggered from another Pennsylvania field, Mr. Lincoln said, "We cannot dedicate, we cannot consecrate, we cannot hallow this ground. The brave men, living and dead, who struggled here, have consecrated it, far above our poor power to add or detract." Lincoln used those words to immortalize their sacrifice. Today our leaders could use those same words to rationalize their reprehensible inaction. We cannot dedicate, we cannot consecrate, we cannot hallow this ground. So we won't. Instead they bicker and buck pass. They thwart private efforts and jostle to claim credit for initiatives that go nowhere. They spend the money on irrelevant wars and elaborate self-congratulations and buying off columnists to write how good a job they're doing instead of doing any job at all. 5 years later, Mr. Bush, we are still fighting the terrorists on these streets. And look carefully, sir, on these 16 empty acres. The terrorists are clearly still winning. And, in a crime against every victim here, and every patriotic sentiment you mouthed, but did not enact, you have done nothing about it. And there is something worse still than this vast gaping hole in the city, and in the fabric of our nation. There is its symbolism of the promise unfulfilled, the urgent oath, reduced to lazy execution. The only positive on 9/11 and the days and weeks that so slowly and painfully followed it was the unanimous humanity, here and throughout the country. The government, the president in particular, was given every possible measure of support. Those who did not belong to his party tabled that. Those who doubted the mechanics of his election ignored that. Those who wondered of his qualifications forgot that. History teaches us that nearly unanimous support of a government cannot be taken away from that government by its critics. It can only be squandered by those who use it, not to heal a nation's wounds, but to take political advantage. Terrorists did not come and steal our newly regained sense of being American first, and political, 50th. Nor did the Democrats. Nor did the media. Nor did the people. The president, and those around him, did that. They promised bipartisanship, and then showed that to them. Bipartisanship meant that their party would rule, and the rest would have to follow, or be branded, with ever-escalating hysteria, as morally or intellectually confused, as appeasers, as those who, in the vice president's words yesterday, validate the strategy of the terrorists. They promised protection, and then showed that to them protection meant going to war against a despot whose hand they had once shaken, a despot who we now learn from our own Senate Intelligence Committee, hated Al-Qaeda as much as we did. The polite phrase for how so many of us were duped into supporting a war, on the false premise that it had something to do with 9/11, is lying by implication. The impolite phrase is impeachable offense. Not once in now 5 years has this president ever offered to assume responsibility for the failures that led to this empty space, and to this, the current, curdled, version of our beloved country. Still, there is a last snapping flame from a final candle of respect and fairness. Even his most virulent critics have never suggested he alone bears the full brunt of the blame for 9/11. Half the time, in fact, this president has been so gently treated that he has seemed not even to be the man most responsible for anything in his own administration. Yet what is happening this very night? A mini-series, created, influenced, possibly financed by, the most radical and cold of domestic political Machiavellis, continues to be televised into homes. The documented truths of the last 15 years are replaced by bald-faced lies, the talking points of the current regime parroted, the whole sorry story blurred by spin to make the party out of office seem vacillating and impotent, and the party in office seem like the only option. How dare you, Mr. President, after taking cynical advantage of the unanimity and love, and transmuting it into fraudulent war and needless death, after monstrously transforming it into fear and suspicion and turning that fear into the campaign slogan of 3 elections. How dare you, or those around you, ever spin 9/11? Just as the terrorists have succeeded, are still succeeding, as long as there is no memorial, and no construction here at Ground Zero, so too, have they succeeded, and are still succeeding, as long as this government uses 9/11 as a wedge to pit Americans against Americans. This is a not point to cite a television program, especially one from March of 1960. But as Disney's continuing sellout of the truth in this country suggests, even television programs can be powerful things. And long ago, a series called The Twilight Zone broadcast a riveting episode entitled The Monsters Are Due on Maple Street. In brief, a meteor sparks rumors of an invasion by extraterrestrials disguised as humans. The electricity goes out. A neighbor pleads for calm. Suddenly his car, and only his car, starts. Someone suggests he must be the alien. Then another man's lights go on. As charges and suspicion and panic overtake the street, guns are inevitably produced. An alien is shot, but he turns out to be just another neighbor, returning from going for help. The camera pulls back to a nearby hill, where 2 extraterrestrials are seen manipulating a small device that can jam electricity. The veteran tells his novice that there's no need to actually attack, that you just turn off a few of the human machines and then they pick the most dangerous enemy they can find, and it's themselves. And then, in perhaps his finest piece of writing, Rod Serling sums it up with words of remarkable prescience: given where we find ourselves tonight, the tools of conquest do not necessarily come with bombs and explosions and fallout. There are weapons that are simply thoughts, attitudes, prejudices, to be found only in the minds of men. For the record, prejudices can kill, and suspicion can destroy, and a thoughtless, frightened search for a scapegoat has a fallout all its own, for the children, and the children yet unborn. When those who dissent are told time and time again, as we will be, if not tonight by the president, then tomorrow by his portable public chorus, that he is preserving a freedom but that if we use any of it, we are somehow un-American, when we are scolded, that if we merely question, we have forgotten the lessons of 9/11, look into this empty space behind me, and the bipartisanship upon which this administration also did not build, and tell me who has left this hole in the ground. We have not forgotten, Mr. President. You have. May this country forgive you. September 11, 2006, 3:19 p.m. at a special comment on 9/11 tonight at 8 p.m. at Countdown with Keith Olbermann broadcasts live from Ground Zero to commemorate 5 years since 9/11. Olbermann will offer a special commentary on how the course of the nation was forever altered by the events of that day and by the actions of the administration in the months and years afterward. Check out this sneak peek, the only positive on 9/11 and the days and weeks that so slowly and painfully followed. It was the unanimous humanity, here, and throughout the country. The government, the president in particular, was given every possible measure of support. Those who did not belong to his party tabled that. Those who doubted the mechanics of his election ignored that. Those who wondered of his qualifications forgot that. History teaches us that nearly unanimous support of a government cannot be taken away from that government by its critics. It can only be squandered by those who use it, not to heal a nation's wounds, but to take political advantage. Terrorists did not come and steal our newly regained sense of being American first and political 50th. Nor did the Democrats. Nor did the media. Nor did the people. The president and those around him did that. They promised bipartisanship, and then showed that to them, bipartisanship meant that their party would rule, and the rest would have to follow, or be branded, with ever-escalating hysteria, as morally or intellectually confused, as appeasers, as those who, in the vice president's words yesterday, validate the strategy of the terrorists. They promise protection, and then showed that to them protection meant going to war against a despot whose hand they had once shaken, a despot who we now learn from our own Senate Intelligence Committee hated Al-Qaeda as much as we did. The polite phrase for how so many of us were duped into supporting a war, on the false premise that it had something to do with 9/11, is lying by implication. The impolite phrase is impeachable offense. Comments? Email Kolbermann@msnbc.com. Watch Countdown each weeknight at 8 p.m. at on MSNBC TV. Sept. 5, 2006, 8:00 p.m. at Have You No Sense of Decency, Sir? It is to our deep national shame, and ultimately it will be to the President's deep personal regret, that he has followed his Secretary of Defense down the path of trying to tie those loyal Americans who disagree with his policies, or even questioned their effectiveness or execution, to the Nazis of the past, and the Al-Qaeda of the present. Today, in the same subtle terms in which Mr. Bush and his colleagues muddied the clear line separating Iraq and 9/11, without ever actually saying, so the president quoted a purported Osama bin Laden letter that spoke of launching a media campaign to create a wedge between the American people and their government. Make no mistake here, the intent of that is to get us to confuse the psychotic scheming of an international terrorist with that familiar bogeyman of the right, the media. The president and the vice president and others have often attacked freedom of speech, and freedom of dissent, and freedom of the press. Now, Mr. Bush has signaled that his unparalleled and unprincipled attack on reporting has a new and venomous side angle, the attempt to link, by the simple expediency of one word media, the honest, patriotic, and indeed vital questions and questioning from American reporters, with the evil of Al-Qaeda propaganda. That linkage is more than just indefensible. It is un-American. Mr. Bush and his colleagues have led us before to such waters. We will not drink again. And the president's rewriting and sanitizing of history, so it fits the expediencies of domestic politics, is just as false, and just as scurrilous. In the 1920s, a failed Austrian painter published a book in which he explained his intention to build an Aryan superstate in Germany and take revenge on Europe, and eradicate the Jews, President Bush said today. The world ignored Hitler's words, and paid a terrible price. Whatever the true nature of Al-Qaeda and other international terrorist threats, to ceaselessly compare them to the Nazi state of Germany serves only to embolden them. Moreover, Mr. Bush, you are accomplishing in part what Osama bin Laden and others see, a fearful American populace, easily manipulated, and willing to throw away any measure of restraint, any loyalty to our own ideals and freedoms, for the comforting illusion of safety. It becomes necessary to remind the president that his administration's recent Nazi kick is an awful and cynical thing. And it becomes necessary to reach back into our history, for yet another quote, from yet another time, and to ask it of Mr. Bush, have you no sense of decency, sir? September 5, 2006, 7:00 p.m. at special comment on Bush's speech today, President Bush followed in the steps of Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld, by comparing war critiques to the Nazis of the past, and the Al-Qaeda of the present. Tonight, Keith Olbermann responds with a special comment on Countdown. You can catch Olbermann's full response at 8 p.m. on MSNBC, but here's a sneak peek now. Mr. Bush has signaled that his unparalleled and unprincipled attack on reporting has a new and venomous side angle: the attempt to link, by the simple expediency of one-word media, the honest, patriotic, and indeed vital questions and questioning from American reporters with the evil of Al-Qaeda propaganda. That linkage is more than just indefensible. It is un-American. Mr. Bush and his colleagues have led us before to such waters. We will not drink again. And comments? Email Kolberman at msnbc.com. Watch Countdown each weeknight at 8 p.m. on MSNBC TV. August 30, 2006, 8:34 p.m. Feeling morally, intellectually confused? The man who sees absolutes, where all other men see nuances and shades of meaning, is either a prophet or a quack. Donald H. Rumsfeld is not a prophet. Mr. Rumsfeld's remarkable speech to the American Legion yesterday demands a deep analysis and the sober contemplation of every American. For it did not merely serve to impugn the morality or intelligence, indeed, the loyalty, of the majority of Americans who oppose the transient occupants of the highest offices in the land. Worse still, it credits those same transient occupants, our employees, with a total omniscience which neither common sense nor this administration's track record at home or abroad suggests they deserve. Dissent and disagreement with government is the life's blood of human freedom, and not merely because it is the first roadblock against the kind of tyranny the men Mr. Rumsfeld likes to think of as his troops still fight, this very evening, in Iraq. It is also essential, because just every once in a while it is right, and the power to which it speaks is wrong. In a small irony, however, Mr. Rumsfeld's speechwriter was adroit in invoking the memory of the appeasement of the Nazis. Far in their time, there was another government faced with true peril with a growing evil powerful and remorseless. That government, like Mr. Rumsfeld's, had a monopoly on all the facts. It too had the secret information. It alone had the true picture of the threat. It too dismissed and insulted its critics in terms like Mr. Rumsfeld's, questioning their intellect and their morality. That government was England's in the 1930s. It knew Hitler posed no true threat to Europe, let alone England. It knew Germany was not terry-arming, in violation of all treaties and accords. It knew that the hard evidence received, which contradicted its own policies, its own conclusions, its own omniscience, needed to be dismissed. The English government of Neville Chamberlain already knew the truth. Most relevant of all, it knew that its staunchest critics needed to be marginalized and isolated. In fact, it portrayed the foremost of them as a bloodthirsty warmonger who was, if not truly senile, at best morally or intellectually confused. That critic's name was Winston Churchill. Sadly, We have no Winston Churchills evident among us this evening. We have only Donald Rumsfeld's demonizing disagreement, the way Neville Chamberlain demonized Winston Churchill. History and £163 million of Luftwaffe bombs over England have taught us that all Mr. Chamberlain had was his certainty and his own confusion. A confusion that suggested that the office can not only make the man, but that the office can also make the facts. Thus, did Mr. Rumsfeld make an apt historical analogy, accepting the fact that he has the battery plugged in backwards. His government, absolute and exclusive in its knowledge, is not the modern version of the one which stood up to the Nazis. It is the modern version of the government of Neville Chamberlain. But back to today's omniscient ones. That about which Mr. Rumsfeld is confused is simply this: this is a democracy. Still, sometimes just barely. And, as such, all voices count, not just his. Had he or his president perhaps proven any of their prior claims of omniscience about Osama bin Laden's plans 5 years ago, about Saddam Hussein's weapons 4 years ago, about Hurricane Katrina's impact 1 year ago, we all might be able to swallow hard and accept their omniscience as a bearable, even useful recipe of fact plus ego. But, to date, this government has proved little besides its own arrogance and its own hubris. Mr. Rumsfeld is also personally confused, morally or intellectually, about his own standing in this matter. From Iraq to Katrina, to the entire fog of fear which continues to envelop this nation, he, Mr. Bush, Mr. Cheney, and their cronies have inadvertently or intentionally profited and benefited, both personally and politically. And yet he can stand up, in public, and question the morality and the intellect of those of us who dare ask just for the receipt for the emperor's new clothes. In what country was Mr. Rumsfeld raised? As a child, of whose heroism did he read? On what side of the battle for freedom did he dream one day to fight? With what country has he confused the United States of America? The confusion we, as its citizens, must now address is stark and forbidding. But variations of it have faced our forefathers, when men like Nixon and M.C. Carthy and Curtis LeMay have darkened our skies and obscured our flag. Note, with hope in your heart, that those earlier Americans always found their way to the light, and we can too. The confusion is about whether the Secretary of Defense and this administration are in fact now accomplishing what they claim the terrorists seek: the destruction of our freedoms, the very ones for which the same veterans Mr. Rumsfeld addressed yesterday in Salt Lake City so valiantly fought. And about Mr. Rumsfeld's other main assertion, that this country faces a new type of fascism. As he was correct to remind us how a government that knew everything could get everything wrong, so too was he right when he said that, though probably not in the way he thought he meant it, this country faces a new type of fascism, indeed. Although I presumptuously use his sign off each night, in feeble tribute, I have utterly no claim to the words of the exemplary journalist Edward Amaro. But never in the trial of 1,000 years of writing could I come close to matching how he phrased the warning to an earlier generation of us, at a time when other politicians thought they and they alone knew everything, and branded those who disagreed confused or immoral. Thus, forgive me for reading Morrow in full. We must not confuse dissent with disloyalty, he said, in 1954. We must remember always that accusation is not proof, and that conviction depends upon evidence and due process of law. We will not walk in fear, one of another. We will not be driven by fear into an age of unreason, if we dig deep in our history and our doctrine, and remember that we are not descended from fearful men, not from men who feared to write, to speak, to associate, and to defend causes that were for the moment unpopular. And so good night, and good luck. Comments? Email Kolberman@msnbc.com. Watch Countdown each weeknight at 8 p.m. on MSNBC TV Org. 30, 2006, 4:31 p.m. Feeling morally, intellectually confused. Yesterday, Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld once again attacked administration critics, asserting those questioning its Iraq and anti-terror policies are trying to appease a new type of fascism, calling them sufferers of moral or intellectual confusion. Tonight, Keith Olbermann returns to Countdown with a special commentary on Rumsfeld's remarks. You can catch Olbermann's full response at 8 p.m. on MSNBC, but here's a sneak peek. It demands a deep analysis and the sober contemplation of every American. Farah did not merely serve to impugn the morality or intelligence, indeed, the loyalty of the majority of Americans who oppose the transient occupants of the highest offices in the land. Worse still, it credits those same transient occupants, our employees, with a total omniscience which neither common sense nor this administration's track record at home or abroad suggests they deserve. Dissent and disagreement with government is the life's blood of human freedom, and not merely because it is the first roadblock against the kind of tyranny the men Mr. Rumsfeld likes to think of as his troops still fight, this very evening, in Iraq. It is also essential because just every once in a while it is right, and the power to which it speaks is wrong. Comments? Email kolberman@msnbc.com. Watch Countdown each weeknight at 8 p.m. on MSNBC TV.